about the closing down, and I kind of hate about you to tell me that again, but the Kennecott Copper Mine, now who was the man that made this announcement?
Richardson.
And what was his title?
He was a superintendent.
He was a superintendent of the Kennecott?
Of the Kennecott Mines.
And this labor dispute, the union, the men had not...
They hadn't organized yet, but they had come up with their demands and the announcement. That's what they were going to do, and then his reply was that they would close down immediately if they organized, that they would grant them the wages and the hours of a union, but they would not recognize the union or their authority.
Yes.
And if they organized, they would close down immediately. If they did not, they would guarantee them 3 years and continue with their drilling and prospecting. And they organized.
And the men went ahead and organized.
Went ahead and organized. And they simply made the announcement up there at Kennecott. Everybody get ready. Catch the last train. It'll be on 38, in November, I believe. October, November is the fall.
And that, they just closed down overnight?
They just closed down overnight. And people just scrambled.
People I've talked to that have been up there have said that the forks were left in the plate, sort of thing. They just went out the door, practically.
Mm-hmm. Anything of any value, they cared anything about, they took with them.
Mm-hmm.
And the last train left.
And they just cleaned it out.
Mm-hmm.
How extraordinary.
This Bill Herman, who was here visiting with me last evening, was the station agent there at the time. He's quite well known here in Palmer. Mm-hmm. And he always enjoys coming up and talking with me.
Oh, I'll bet. Yes. Well, now you said that also there was the town of McCarthy. The closing down of this mine.
Closed down McCarthy as well.
It closed down McCarthy. Mm-hmm. It closed down Chitna.
Chitna.
It closed down Cordova.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of the people.
See, Chitna was a divisional point. That the ore was shipped down. See, it was quite a grade, and they hauled huge loads down to Chitna. And then that train went back. And the train from Cordova came up and picked up this ore on more flat cars, you see. And that was the divisional point, and that's where the shops were.
I see.
At Chitna.
Mm-hmm.
So when they closed down Chitna, they just wiped the town out.
Yes.
Of course, Cordova still had the fishermen. But
it was no longer the terminus of the railroad. It no longer had the shipping going through the, the transshipment of the docks.
Uh-huh.
I mean, all of this contributed to the...
To the welfare of Cordova.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then,
when they tore up the railroad, it left Cordova landlocked.
Now, when you say they tore up the railroad, I don't know about that.
They immediately started pulling up the rails. They sold the rolling stock to Japan. That was before the war, you see, in 38.
Oh, I see.
And they sold the rolling stock to Japan. It was hauled out of Cordova in great big freighters.
Mm-hmm.
And then they pulled up the rails.
I see.
And then, as I say, it left Cordova landlocked. No way of access except either by air or water.
Now, I was told that they had run out of ore.
To the contrary. Well, they could guarantee him 3 years. And they continued drilling. And they may... Well, you see, originally, it was a slide that attracted Kennecott. And it was, practically pure copper. It was the richest copper mine in the world. Not the largest, but the richest.
Now, somebody told me who had worked there in the mid-30s. He said that he had gone around another firm, a competitive mining firm with headquarters in New York, had acquired an ore body around the mountainside, an adjacent area. And they had gone in at some time to mine this. This company had mined, but they had no way to get it out. They had shipped it out over the, what was the name of the railroad?
The railroad, the Copper, what did they call it? Well, it was the Copper River
Railroad. Anyway, the Copper River Railroad. He shipped it out over the Guggenheim Railroad, and then he had had to ship it to the Guggenheim smelter, and by the time he got the bill of sale, balanced against the freight charges and the smelting charges, he had no profit left. So that this other competitive owner's ore body was never possible to mine it.
See, they had a sliding scale on the railroad, and according to the value of your ore is what they charged for their freight. It was a sliding scale. And then, to keep it out of interstate commerce, they had just a trestle across the Copper River, which they were continually working on, of course. It took continual work to keep it up. So it was in course of construction, which kept them out of the interstate commerce laws.
Oh.
Guggenheim, you see, was pretty...
He knew the angles.
Yeah.
Yes,
he was a politician. So, the ore, it wasn't feasible for any other company to operate it there.
Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
It didn't cost Kennecott anything to ship, except the upkeep of the railroad and the steamship line. But anybody shipping over this paid for the upkeep.
Let's see, the railroad was built in, what, 1913, 12, 11, 12?
11, I think.
11.
Yeah.
And you went in the country in 1916, 15. And you built your roadhouse when?
The roadhouse had been built by a man by the name of Clarkin, but he started selling liquor, and that didn't coincide with the wishes of the mining men. Men who had the mind to see the men would get in there and get to drinking, and they wouldn't go to work. So they kind of put him out of business. So the place was idle. And my husband saw the possibilities. The place being remodeled and built up, made into a decent place. And so he bought it and fixed it up. And we couldn't do much with the outside, but we remodeled the inside and made it very attractive. And
Oh, he'd put the... Clarkin had put the well in.
No,
it you
was
put
just
the well
a shell.
In. I see. Know.
And it wasn't even a basement. But it was on a bench. And they went in underneath the house, you see, and excavated under the house.
I see. And put the basement in under it
mm-hmm.
with the furnace.
With the furnace and the well.
I see. Now, let's see, the railroad was in, but you were 16 miles beyond the railroad.
Well, about 17 miles. Say, we estimated 17 miles from McCarthy.
But there was a pretty good road up there.
No.
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 How did they get up there, 17 miles from McCarthy up there?
Horses.
They rode horseback up.
Yeah, and
the horse and buggy.
No. Horses just packed and saddled, and they had to swim the river sometimes. My husband was a pretty good river man, and he could pick pretty good crossings. But the water was lowest at 11 o'clock in the forenoon and highest at 11 o'clock at night. You see, that water was a glacier. It's a glacier stream. It comes down from under the Nazina Glacier. And the heat, the atmosphere, you see, would melt the ice. And it would, at 11 o'clock, it was
the runoff, and by 11 o'clock the next morning, the night of cool night had dropped the water level, so that the runoff reached you
so
the lowest.
So they would stay over, you see, at the roadhouse in order to cross at 11 o'clock, and it's around 11 and 12.
I see.
10 and 11.
I see.
Wrong. About that time. Come in!
Oh, I wondered if you were
going to
see it.
It's us. We got set up again.
Don't let me interrupt.
Will you interrupt? I was just learning, will you come in and sit down? It's not my room to invite you in, excuse me.
Yes, my next door neighbor.
Yeah.
I have a couple of things I have to do, I'll get them done. And then may I just come back and slip in? Mm-hmm. All right. Because tonight, you know, we have this discussion group at 6:30, so and I have to make a few notes, and I have to clean my teeth and make a phone call, and then I'll... I'm glad you're still here. Well, I hope you're not too hungry.
No.
Would you like some milk?
No, thanks.
Mm-hmm. Right. I offered to bring a tray. No, I'll go find something down the line. I'm enjoying, this is a food for the soul. You know, the body can afford to do without a bit.
Well, you've really found something good.
Oh, my, yes.
Good.
Oh,
I'm so glad. Well, I'll tell you what, when I come back, shall I just slip in without knocking and I won't break in?
Good.
I won't
come in any time.
All right. Mm-hmm. So it won't interrupt your...
Mm-hmm. I'll just go ahead and I'll just put this right over here so that Kay can have a chair. It looks to me, I had kind of wanted to check the machine to make sure my gauges were doing what they were supposed to be doing. I really find this most fascinating, and I'm appreciative of your...
Well, it's just information is, I know, fairly valuable, because there was no record kept of anything. Things just happened.
Yes.
And then you've heard so many different interpretations of it.
The Kennicott.
Yes. Mm-hmm. That we were out of ore, and what really happened, you see, copper had dropped 12.5 cents, and the Kennicott Company offered to continue operation if they could store that copper and not pay taxes on it, and still until they sold it, until they released it. But they had to pay the taxes when it was taken out of the ground. They couldn't store it without paying taxes. And at 12.5 cents, they couldn't do it. So in the meantime, they had gone down into Chile. And that was when they closed down. They had that ace in the hole. And they just moved down into Chile and opened up the big copper mine down there. And there they had cheap labor and fewer restrictions and no taxes.
The demands of American labor and American taxes combined were the drop in the price of ore itself.
And the drop in the price.
Those three factors put it out of business. With the rising price of copper, they could reopen the mine now.
They could if they had a highway. That's what they've been waiting for. When I was up there, I think it was in 70 when this time I was up there. And that was when this engineer, it was a mineralogist and a geologist. And let's see, what outfit were they up for? It's this big steel company. It's a big steel outfit. And they were figuring on taking over the mine. And Mr. Jones and the mineralogist, I've forgotten what his name was, I wasn't very well acquainted with him, and they went down into the mine, were down there for 3 weeks. They put up a tent down there.
Is that right?
And stayed right down in the mine. And they examined all the stopes and estimated what was in them and what could be acquired. And they went all through the workings and clear over into the mother lode. You see, they had 80 miles of rail.
So much.
Yeah.
Now that wasn't pulled out, was it?
No.
That's still there.
Still there. And the Kennicott, it didn't need any, I suppose in places probably had to be shored, but it was permafrost. And never thawed out. They left pillars.
Oh.
But it wasn't...
I wonder if that has been affected at all.
It wasn't timbered.
I see.
This Mr. Jones told me that after all these years, why, there were animals that had starved to death under there. There were such squirrels and what else did he say? I think he said there was an owl.
Hmm.
At any rate, he said they were in perfect preservation. So they weren't...
Isn't that strange? My goodness.
The frost.
Yes.
So the mine is just frozen.
It is that cold in there, then.
Mm-hmm.
Most mines are what, as you go deeper and deeper, they get warmer, but I think it's 48 or 58 degrees or something mostly in mines. They're not really cold.
No, but these are frozen.
Those are frosted.
It's permafrost, right? In the frost. You see, in the original, what attracted them, what the Guggenheim, the reason he went into it, there was a slide. It come down that was almost pure copper. A $3 million right in sight. All they had to do was sack it up and ship it. And of course, in those days, $3 million was a huge
amount. Oh, yes. Oh, that's right. Certainly. Mm-hmm. Yes, it isn't like today where a mechanic makes $50,000 a year.
No.
I talked to a man the other day, a mechanic who makes $50,000 a year. Are you familiar with the discovery? I know that this must be thoroughly documented. I know it's thoroughly documented. I just don't recall offhand the story of the discovery of that.
Well, there was an Indian who told them about it. And then this, no, it was a standard, wait a minute. Birch. Steve Birch was freighting up. Had a pack train and was freighting around the prospectors, you know, carrying the supplies to them, and he heard this story. So he went up there and was enough of a mineralogist to realize that there was some truth in it. But he got an engineer up there. At least he contacted the Guggenheims. And they sent an engineer up, and when this engineer reported it, they said he was crazy. But then, of course, Steve Birch kept working on it and made this deal with the Guggenheims eventually, showing him what really was there. But it was what was practically in sight to convince him. So Steve Birch, during his lifetime, was the president of the company.
Oh, is that so?
Oh, yes.
Oh,
the Guggenheim, of course, was the,
an interest in it. Then he didn't sell outright.
No.
I see. You knew him. Did you?
Oh, yes. Everybody up there knew Steve. Yeah, that is. As much as they could know anybody that was had let everything go to his head. His head swelled up all out of proportion. And he had to have a private car to travel in. And one of the men that was in charge, who was it? They had so many different superintendents there at first. I forgot who it was. But at any rate, he heard that Steve was coming up with his bride with a private car. And so they built a beautiful home for him. Of course, no place for him to stay there in the camp, but they built this beautiful place. And he fired him for it. He wouldn't even go up. They stayed in their private car with the shades drawn. And they fired them for all this expenditure that wasn't authorized. That was Steve Birch. And his brother, G. Howard Birch, he bought Dan Creek and gave it to G. Howard Birch for a wedding present. So it was G. Howard Birch that I knew and had nothing but contempt for. They were just not real people.
Well, isn't that interesting? Where had they come from?
Someplace from the east. They went back every year. G. Howard closed down the mine and had a caretaker. And then a Jap that worked for him, his private cook. And he'd leave the Jap there to watch the caretaker to see if the caretaker did what he was supposed to do. Not one other thing. Oh, he was a tyrant. A tyrant.
Gee, you hear about people like that, but we don't have too many in Alaska, really.
Well, one of the stories they tell about him was that some fellow who had worked up there, an Irishman, I knew the fellow too, and he met Steve Howard, or Steve Birch, down at the dock as he got off the boat. And he walked up to him and he said, Mr. Birch, I'm awfully glad to meet you. And Birch was kind of dumbfounded, stood and looked at him for a minute, and he said, I've been working for your brother. No, he said, I always said that you were the dirtiest blankety blank 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 that ever lived, but I've worked for your brother since.
And now he knew.
he wasn't bad. Oh, that was it. He was apologizing. He said, I want to apologize to you, Mr. Birch. That was it. He said, I used to say that you were the worst blankety blank 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 that ever lived, but I've worked for your brother since.
And now I know him differently.
How about that? He was apologizing.
Yes, I understand. Yeah. So they were not exactly well loved.
No, no. That's the feeling that everybody had for them. They were very disagreeable people. Never left anything behind them that was worth having.
How did this come about? Now, they ran this Kennecott mine all through the years.
Oh, yes. Well, then they had a manager in there, Stannard.
I'm going to have to go out and get a cough. I've got a cough.
You don't have a paper cup in there, do you?
In the bathroom there. Right there, inside the door is a light. There.
I get a funny tickle if my throat contracts, and I don't know what makes it do that. But I'll get you another cup before I go.
I haven't heard this aspect, you know, in talking with men who worked there. Men who would work for a few years, maybe, and then leave. They really didn't bring out the details of this.
Well, toward the last, this was in the early days.
Yes.
Well, then after Mr. Stannard took over, during the First World War.
Oh.
Mr. Stannard was the executive up there, and he was all right. They got along all right with him.
Well, did the Guggenheims have any influence in pulling the Birches out?
I think so.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know just what the transaction was. About that time, they bought the Mother Lode. But they had mined up to the Mother Lode and in under the Apex. So, and Arthur Godfrey owned the Mother Lode. And so he sold to him at that advantageous price. I don't know how much he did get. Nobody did know, ever did know. Well, then the whole thing was reorganized, and the stock was watered, and I don't know what the transaction was, but that was how when Stannard got in.
I see.
You know, those things are manipulated so that nobody really understands.
That is true.
You should get a lot more stock.
The business transactions on the East Coast were far removed from here.
Oh, yes. Yeah. It was like that Fairbanks exploration, you know, that was a New York concern.
Now, the USSR&M, that wasn't a Guggenheim Corporation, was it?
I don't think so.
I don't know if that was Rockefeller or something. It was a major...
combine.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm.
I think many of them were interested in all of those people.
Mm-hmm. The big minerals company.
And of course, this Kennecott thing, because of the steamship line and the railroad in connection, made it a big concern.
Mm-hmm. Now, did they own the Alaska Steamship Company too at that time? Mm-hmm.
And the smelter.
I see.
And the railroad.
Yes, of course.
You see, one thing just required the other, and they built the railroad first and then took over the steamship line and then the smelter.
When you read the Iron Trail...
And they really didn't contribute much to the country. There was no reinvestment in the country.
No, this is one of those great exploitative things.
Yes, it was. There was no question about it.
It's always been the tragedy of Alaska.
Yes. And they skimmed off the cream. You see, even if Kennecott reopened, it would be as rich, no doubt, as any other copper mine. But the high grade has been...
The vast high grade has gone. That is a hard thing to conceive, you know, how brilliant that must have been.
Yeah. Well, this ore was so rich that they first shipped that they had to open up a cheaper, easier mine, a place in Latouche, to supply with the, they have to have?
Slag.
Slag.
Yeah. Slag.
In order to smelt this rich ore.
That's why they opened Latouche.
Latouche.
I see, the complimentary low-grade ore.
That's it. It was a kind of a subsidiary.
I see. Now, that was over toward Catala, was mm-hmm. it? Catala? Mm-hmm. Did you ever get over to Catala?
No. No, I haven't.
See, that, well, no, because Cordova was established by the Guggenheims mm-hmm. after Catala and took the Catala people away. Mm-hmm. And then
Latouche, Catala? No.
Mm-mm.
No, no.
No, but Latouche. It was nearby. It was down the bay. Down
yeah.
The,
yeah, it was down the bay.
And it was still in Prince William Sound.
Yes. Well, anyway, that was where they shipped the ore for the to handle with the Kennecott.
Did you ever go to Latouche?
No.
You never saw it there? That was a coastal area. Let me think. The one I was thinking of, I was trying to think of the Birches. They were real villains on the scene.
Yes.
Now, when Rex Beach wrote The Iron Trail, I don't think they I was trying to recall the novel. It's been years since I read it, but I don't think they figured in there, actually.
No, I don't think so. I don't recall uh-huh. the story either, although they mm-hmm. filmed it up there, you know.
Well, they did.
In the Abercrombie Canyon. Yeah.
Were you there then?
I was there then.
Uh-huh. Is that so? Yeah. Now, that's interesting. When was this that they... Uh-huh. Was in the 30s did they make the movie?
Rounded in... No, it was in, I think in the 20s.
In the 20s, mm-hmm. I see. That wasn't Clark Gable, that was...
No. I don't know who starred in that. I know they lost a couple of men. See, they just came up to use the Abercrombie Canyon for a substitute of the... what's the canyon they had to in going into Dawson in the early days, you know?
Oh, the... do you mean on the Yukon?
The Yukon.
White Pass...
The White Pass, yes.
The rapids.
Yeah.
The rivers,
yes.
Whatever they are.
Yeah.
White Horse Rapids.
Yeah, well, they were going to do the same thing up here in the Abercrombie Canyon. And they had trained men for doing it and all this. And I think they lost 3 men. Then they had to get a bunch of old-timers to come in there and finish the job.
And do what they had to have done. I see.
Yeah. Okay. Shoot the rapids for it.
Well, that's an interesting little side tidbit there. You were telling me earlier about the water going up and down and the horses fording it.
Mm-hmm.
And did you have a breakup on the river like they mm-hmm. have? It was a big enough river to have an ice breakup.
Well, yes, it would be quite a breakup. And then we'd have what they called, a pothole. They'd say, well, of course, amongst ourselves, we'd just say the pothole broke over in back of the glaciers. See, the Nazina Glacier and the Russell Glacier and the Frederica. All the water, the drainage from them, goes into the Scolai Basin, which is right behind the Nazina. And when that would get full, it would raise the Nazina, and this water would come out from under there with a tremendous rush. And it would flood the valley. The valley was about 2.5 miles wide. And ordinarily, it was a stream. Well, a good heavy stream, but I mean, it wouldn't be clear across. This would flood it from bank to bank.
I see, and you were above that level.
Mm-hmm. Just above it, we've had it come up almost into our garden.
That is a kind of like the Kinnick. Now the Kinnick mm-hmm. is a different thing. There the glacier mm-hmm. comes down and dams the lake, actually.
Yeah, well, this is different. The lake was behind the glacier, and it would lift. It finally, the glacier now is so broken up, I doubt very much whether they could cross it with horses now. But the trail into Shoshana went over the Nazina Glacier. You had to cross the Nazina Glacier.
Oh, I see.
And, then right over on the other side of it was the Scolai Basin. And when the flood would come, it would just raise the...
And that lake would push out underneath the glacier.
Yeah. And great... It would just shatter parts of the glacier. Great icebergs would come down there as big as a good-sized house. Huge things.
Oh, my. And how far?
Trees coming down just end over end, you know, would cut in the banks on either side.
I see. One of those great dramas of nature.
Yeah. Yes,
oh,
it was.
What a thrill.
And that happened every year.
And how far
it doesn't
your
happen
lodge?
Anymore.
Yeah, it doesn't happen
no,
anymore.
No, you see, it's shattered that glacier, so that now there's a continual drainage, and a heavier water flow than there used to be. That is, ordinarily, but it doesn't break anymore. So then the channels cut themselves down and stay where they belong.
When would that happen? When would that ice go out or that flood.
Well, we go out in the long, well, latter part of August, middle of August.
I see.
Uh-huh. Sometimes earlier. Yeah,
through the
on
summer
the,
of melting
uh-huh.
bone.
Depends on the temperature. Of the
it's been some time since you were up there, I suppose.
Well, I was up there in 70.
You were
time.
There in 70. Mm-hmm. Well, you've observed those glaciers then for over 50 years.
Oh, yes.
What changes have you observed in the 55 years?
Well, that's the landmarks, they're no longer the same, of course. They're just, some of the glaciers are shattered, the Nazina especially, with this tremendous rush every year coming out, it's just shattered it. There used to be a few crevices, of course, but...
It was a pretty much of a solid mass of
pretty
ice.
Pretty much.
Mm-hmm. And it's no more. Have they retreated particularly?
Oh, yes. What was his name? He was the president of a university.
Terrence Moore? No, not Moore, but
was
now Moore.
Dr. One time Bill was up there visiting us and he wanted to contact Bill and somebody told him.
It wasn't Bill Allen, it wasn't Terrence Moore. We're trying to think
used
of the name
to fly
of the president that had
used
his own
fly
plane.
His own plane.
Yes, the University of Alaska president, that he was very interested in geology. And he took a lot of aerial photographs.
Mm-hmm. He went in before that with Andy Taylor. Andy Taylor was his guide.
Yes.
And
then it wasn't good.
No.
Then he wanted to contact Bill, and somebody told him Bill was up visiting us at Nan Creek. So he came up there. Well, then he recognized and remembered me, he was from the roadhouse, when he'd come up with Andy Taylor.
Oh.
And he said he had just come from the Nazina. And he said, you wouldn't recognize it. He said, it was not the same place at all.
Well, this is something that struck me. You know, in the last 30 years, I've seen the glaciers change so spectacularly.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The Juneau ice cap, the one we used to take off and fly mm-hmm. up over it. Oh, hundreds of feet thick ice, mm-hmm. and now it's all dirt. It's all, so they've retreated back, and what used to be these great glaciers hanging down over the cliffs, it's you could walk up a long way inland. Uh-huh. It's all retreated back.
Well, he said that you wouldn't recognize the Nazina. I haven't been up that way, for many years, not since my husband passed down. Jim, I used to go up there with Jim, of course. But,
Now, how about dog traction or dog teams? Well, you had horses.
Yes, well, we used to go in there with dog teams in the winter.
Mm-hmm. And did you keep dogs for
oh,
the
yes.
purpose of...
Yeah, we always had a team out the roadhouse. And what are you making?
I'm making a sample to see how many inches, stitches per inch and so forth this yarn produces.
Oh, I see. You're starting a new thing.
I'm going to make a dress of it for winter. And I always make a specimen.
Come in. Oh, Terry, dear.
We have a congregation.
Yes.
Yeah.
And what have you been doing?
Well, I just was on my way home from work, and I thought that I would...
This is,
and
this is Hartman.
I'm Neville Jacobs.
I'm glad to meet you.
Terry, and you've met Kay.
Yes.
And
you've
met Hartman.
You got something going?
Well,
no.
I could let you have this chair.
No, I'm not going to stay. I just wanted to check on her and say hi.
I have to leave at 6:15 because I'm in that discussion group at 6:30.
Well, I think I've about...
about exhausted you.
You didn't give me a
surprise.
All right. I'll give you my card, Kay, before I go.
Right.
But
asking for
I'm
some
down
early
from
information from the early days up there at Kennecott.
Yes, early day information
of
the Kennecott area.
Oh.
And I found a rich storehouse of information, as well as a rich person.
Yes, she's one of the best.